Good afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. It is June 28, 2017. Public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1050 relating to sentencing for serious sex crimes. Ms. Naburka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, Senate Bill 1050 provides a presumptive sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of release for a person sentenced for certain serious sex crimes if the person has a prior conviction for the same crime or an equivalent one in another jurisdiction. Currently, individuals convicted of these crimes are sentenced to a mandatory minimum of 25 years in prison. The crimes subject to the measure are rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree. The original staff measure summary and the fiscal impact statement are available on OLIS. The measure previously had a public hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on April 12th. The fiscal impact of the measure is indeterminate. Any additional cost to the Department of Corrections would occur after the current mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years was served and would be dependent on the life expectancy of the individual. Public Defense Services costs could increase due to the increased penalty in the measure, and the increased costs are estimated to range between $1.6 million and $2.7 million a biennium. It would require additional general fund for PDSC if that were to be the case.
Co-Chair Starr, so we can start a conversation. Is there a public hearing on it? Oh, gee, I was going to just go right on the work session.
Do you have sign up? President Courtney was here.
Oh, no. There is no one signed up to testify. I don't see the sponsor of the bill.
Okay.
All right. Well, then we're moving on to our work session.
I already opened a work session, so I need a motion from you.
Yes,
Co-Chair Winters, I move Senate Bill 1050 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves Senate Bill 1050 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I'm just going to.
Yes, Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm a little nervous about costs on something like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money to put somebody.
You mean indeterminate?
Yeah, well, indeterminate in the life sentence is indeterminate on the high side. So that's an issue.
Any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. So we'll all take it. And then Senator Courtney will take it on the floor. Who would like to take this on the House floor?
I can do that.
Okay. Representative Poos.
So John isn't here. Yet.
He isn't here?
So we
can't do that. Yeah.
We could open the public hearing.
Okay. Okay. I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2687. Here's my representative, Evans.
Senator.
It's all yours, Representative.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. For the record, I'm Paul Evans, State Representative for House District 20, but I'm here today in my capacity as Chairman of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. This bill, we call Lend-Lease, is an emergency preparedness equipment pre-positioning bill. I'll walk you through it real quickly and talk about how we got here. 2687 is one of our top priorities, one of the top two, in fact. And truth be told, it is an improved version of the committee bill we had in 2016, which Representative Huffman and I believe Representative Peluso were both a part of. We almost got it done last session, but we wanted to improve it and bring it back this. This measure seeks to accomplish the following. Number one, establish a process as well as a funding mechanism for priority equipment placement, pre-event, turnkey, ready to go at the beginning of a disaster. The reason that we want to do that is because it will buy down the costs of the disaster in both lives and property damaged. We know that we can get equipment where it needs to go. Minutes matter. Number two, you'll also ensure interoperability of emergency equipment, as well as availability, where needed, to provide us with the economies of scale in terms of purchase, as well as simplicity for training and use. Number three, this is to replicate a very successful federal program, often called the Urban Area Security Initiative, or at least it was before, I think it has a new name, where the Department of U.S. Department of Homeland Security recognized in the aftermath of 9/11 that instead of just sending money to every big city to buy things that they didn't necessarily need, what they did is they actually put together regional priority lists. They helped them buy them, give them grants, and made sure that they were all interoperable so they could be moved around a region from time to time when they were needed. The best part of the deal, though, is the local agency gets to use it when there's not an emergency. So in many cases, folks have access to equipment that they couldn't otherwise purchase. That is the point of bringing that federal model to this state. These grants have made a profound difference within the metro area already. House Bill 2687 tries to build upon that model and provide especially areas in the highest risk that we have identified that often are reliant upon volunteers, reliant upon resource-poor districts, the opportunity to give them better equipment so that we can both have it ready during times of disaster and they can have it during times of 24/7. How it's going to work is this way. The Oregon Homeland Security Council, with input from many other agencies, experts, and organizations, will identify a priority list for pre-event placement. That list will be aligned with existing emergency preparedness strategic plans, including the playbook and other tools. The equipment on the list will be specified in order to assure interoperability. Sometimes, as you might know, in public safety, one district wants to buy a particular police car with these lights and another district wants to buy it. In order to cut through all that, state will actually purchase these things and then provide the purchased equipment on a long-term lease, and the price of the lease, and that's why we call it lease, not give, is they have to maintain it and they have to make sure that they can operate it. And if they fail to do that, then the partners have to return the equipment. But in most cases, agencies that get an opportunity to have a tool they wouldn't otherwise have, we believe, will certainly find a way to maintain the equipment. Equipment will be distributed to partners and used as needed by them, unless and until usage of the equipment is identified as a critical requirement for a large-scale presidential-sized disaster, or the organization demonstrates, like I said before, an inability to maintain it. The equipment will be made available for the purchase for the organization at the end of its normal shelf life. For example, a rescue boat may be for Vernonia. After 10 years where the rescue boat doesn't have much value left, they would be given an opportunity, the first opportunity to purchase if they didn't want it. Any other partner in the network would have that opportunity. So the idea is to use equipment as best we can for as long as we can, and at the end of that normal shelf life, make it available to folks that have a need, and over time, both provide more equipment and pre-deployment and also help some agencies, through sweat equity, get into some equipment they wouldn't otherwise necessarily have. This strategic investment allows us significant added capacities at the local and regional levels where we need them, while simultaneously providing partners with equipment that they might not otherwise have. This bill in the past has had support from Tillamook County, a number of other emergency management folks. Mark Labhart, who's now retired, was a voice in AOC emergency management. He was very excited about this bill when it was a committee bill. I understand he's even more excited now that we've made some tweaks on it. We also have the support, and I believe it's in the materials list, from State Treasurer Reed, recognizing that he thinks this is a smart investment of time and effort. I want to also commend the Oregon Military Department. The first fiscal that came down the pike was a little bit higher than we had hoped. They worked very hard to sharpen their pencils and find a way to set this program up so that as we move throughout time, if we get this passed and we're able to demonstrate good use, the systems in place will be able to hopefully over time continue the bonding program. That's as fast as I can say what we're trying to do, and I ask for your help.
Aren't there questions? Yes, Senator Frederick.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to see this particular bill. I want to talk with you afterwards about a storage unit approach that I was trying to get through, but it was a tax credit that obviously we weren't getting very many tax credits through. So, but I am When you're talking about equipment, what kind of equipment are you talking about here? You're not just talking about a boat, and you're not just talking about, are you talking about blankets, shovels, rakes? What are you talking about there?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Senator Frederick, the first phase would probably be larger than blankets and those types of materials, though I think long-term that would make sense for caches. Right now, I'll give you an example. When I was working for Governor Kulongoski, we had a, you might remember in 2009, avian flu became a major issue and a concern. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment where the health department and the emergency management folks were together, and we recognized that there were about 41 ventilators in the state of Oregon total, because hospitals generally, they aren't encouraged to keep additional equipment on that they're not going to use very often because it's not profitable. Makes sense. But ventilators for avian flu is one of those things that was the critical element. And 41 ventilators wouldn't go very far. So we recognize that there are a lot of areas of response and recovery and activity that are needed when you do a complex disaster response. And we need to have the conversation where we prioritize the most important and then basically work sector by sector by sector. So, for example, I don't want to say what the list will be because I think there's going to be a lot of conversation about that. But I would imagine among the top priority would be generators. Among the top priority would be vehicles that can transport people. So, for example, one of the things that we've learned over the last many years is that getting people out of a situation is at least as important as helping the wounded in it. Making sure that we have radio communications equipment that can actually transmit and get the messages where they need to go. So I think it's going to go across the spectrum. I envision us trying to make sure that we, again, focus those areas we know are at highest risk first, that we try to make sure we stretch the dollars as far as we can, and then as we get a little more comfort with the pre-deployment schedule, then we can actually look at category by category. So I suspect it will, over time, include many of the things you mentioned. But I know generators, power, safe food, safe water, and communications are generally the things that I think we're going to be leaning toward first.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have Sean McCormick.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, member of the committee. I'm Sean McCormick. I'm the finance director for the Oregon Military Department, and I have the pleasure to be here today to talk to you about House Bill 2687. Before I do that, though, the Adjutant General and Dave Stuckey wanted me to pass on their thanks to the entire committee. They're down at Forest Grove today for the rededication of the Forest Grove Armory, and the legislature was very generous in appropriating about $1.1 million to help us deal with some serious lead issues, HVAC system replacement issues, and a roof replacement at that particular facility, so they wanted me to pass on their thanks to everyone. To the bill, the military department is officially neutral on House Bill 2687, but we do have a few comments we want to get on the record. As Representative Evans alluded, it does create a new program to be managed by the Office of Emergency Management with the goal of getting emergency preparedness equipment downstream to local communities for their use. The program would be very similar to a couple of equipment programs that we currently manage, the Homeland Security Grant Program being one, and the Urban Area Security Initiative, again alluded to by Representative Evans. With what's in the bill, this one would be sufficiently larger than what the Homeland Security is and the Urban Area Security Initiatives in both size and scope. I think it's fair to say that grants administration, grants management, which is what this would be, a grant program, is really in the sweet spot of what OEM does. They manage a number of programs: Homeland Security, the Emergency Management Performance Grant, Public Assistance Grants, Hazard Mitigation Grants, and a slew of others. So it's really what they do well. The office is also very adept at developing and prioritizing requests, and I think prioritization is going to be a key piece of this legislation, as well as working with a diverse group of stakeholders, which is something OEM also does very, very well. I know they're very excited to potentially be working with the Homeland Security Council in developing broadly categories of equipment that could be used in mass care, communication, energy generation, alternative energy. I think we would try to not reinvent the wheel if we can help it, though we'll try to use tools such as FEMA's approved equipment list, or AEL. It's a list of about 775 pieces of equipment that's currently available that you can pay for with grant dollars. So that'd be a very useful tool for us. We would also make sure that whatever equipment we buy meets the fiscal and capitalization requirements associated with the Article Q bonds that I believe are meant to be the financing mechanism for this program. While OEM does really excel grants management, additional resources are going to be needed to make the program successful. Program development, rulemaking, procurement, long-term reporting, on-site inspections, all those things take a lot of time and effort. And unfortunately, we just don't have those resources currently in. We have submitted a fiscal impact statement, worked with the representative on that, calling for program staff, fiscal staff, potentially some procurement folks. That's generally the fiscal make or the makeup of our grants administration team across the full spectrum of OEM. The positions are all slated to be funded 50-50, 50% with general fund, 50% with federal funds. The source of the federal funds would be the Emergency Management Performance Grant. It's what we call the people grant. It pays for that city, county, and tribal emergency manager, the 50% portion of those. And that would be a key funding piece for this program. I did want to share with the group that over the last several years, EMPG funding has been very, very stable, between $5 and $5.2 million on an annual basis coming into Oregon. The president's 2018 budget request does call for a 20% reduction into EMPG funds. As you all know, budget processing takes a long time, especially at the federal level, so we don't know if that's actually going to come to fruition. If it does, it would mean about $1 million less coming into Oregon on a federal funding basis. If that were to occur, we would definitely be coming back to this group to look for a lot of help, this program being one of those areas we'd like some help on, because we don't want to impact city and county and tribal emergency managers by taking funding away from them for any purpose, because they're the people on the ground and they're doing the good work that this grant program will definitely assist in. So in closing, I just want to say that the military department and the Office of Emergency Management are looking forward to doing everything they can, should the bill become law, to create a highly successful grant program. And we're working with the representative, Homeland Security Council, LFO, CFO, and others to make it happen. And that concludes my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2687 and open up a work session on House Bill 3067. John.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, House Bill 3067 appropriates $200,000 of general fund to the Department of Administrative Services for the 1719 biennium to distribute to Marion and Polk counties to implement court care pilot programs. This measure previously had a public hearing in this subcommittee on June 5th. And according to public testimony provided at that hearing, the intent is to split the funds evenly between Marion and Polk counties. We have no recommended amendments. We're ready to move as is.
Thank you. Co-Chair Stark.
Co-Chair Winters, I move House Bill 367 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves House Bill 3067 be moved to the Ways and Means, recommends that House Bill 3067 be moved to the Ways and Means full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So moved. Let's see, we need carriers. I think since it's Marion Polk County, maybe I'll take it to full and take it to the floor. And let's see who's the closest to Marion County. The House, Huffman.
Happy New Day.
Thank you. I am closing the work session on House Bill 3067 and opening a work session on House Bill 3078. Ms. Nuburka.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, committee members. House Bill 3078 makes changes and modifications to several public safety programs and sentences for crimes. It increases the limit for short-term transitional leave from prison from 90 to 120 days. It modifies two Measure 57 crimes, theft in the first degree and identity theft, to permit shorter presumptive sentences with stricter supervision. And it expands the number of offenders that may be eligible to participate in the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program by including offenders who are pregnant at the time of sentencing and by requiring courts to impose participation in the program under certain conditions. The Criminal Justice Commission is directed to study the impact of these changes on prison use, recidivism, and public safety, and report back to the legislature annually. We have a -8 amendment, which adds $7 million from the general fund for the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, with language directing the funds toward downward departure prison diversion programs provided by counties. The -8 amendment also adds $1 million from the general fund to the Oregon, to the Department of Justice's domestic and sexual violence services and programs.
Chair Winters, I move the adoption of the -8 amendment to House Bill 3078.
Co-Chair Stark recommends the adoption of the -8 amendments to House Bill 3078. Is there a discussion?
I'll save my discussion for the next.
Okay. Is it?
I'll save it too.
You'll save your discussion later?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there objection? Okay. Co-Chair Stark.
Co-Chair Winters, I move House Bill 3078 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Stark moves House Bill 3078 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. I've expressed this previously in our public hearings. There's a lot of stuff in this bill that I really like and appreciate. The family or the short-term trans leave, the family sentencing alternative, the investment in the Senate Bill 416 type programs. I really like that stuff. I personally am still struggling with the Measure 57 portion about policy-wise whether that is the best way to deal with these issues in our communities. I've had a lot of people from my community and the law enforcement community reach out to me in regard to that and their concerns about it. That being said, I do also understand the financial ramifications of what this is intended to do, the money that it's intended to save. I hope our numbers are accurate on that. Given my role as a sub-chair of a committee that's supposed to be focused on budget rather than policy, today I'm planning on giving a courtesy yes to make sure this moves forward in this stage, and we can discuss what my vote will be after at this point.
Representative Huffman and Representative Sanchez.
Oh, actually,
it's okay. You guys can go first.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The senators will yield to the House for a moment.
so kind. We are blessed. The Co-Chair Winters and I had a brief discussion about the financial end of it, which has been plaguing me. I do want to echo Co-Chair Stark's comments on the policy end of stuff. I like 95% of what's in the bill. The Measure 57 part, it would not hurt my feelings to see that come out. Having said that, I want to have a further discussion on the financial end of it. So I'm going to today, and reserve my right to change, I'm going to do what Senator Thompson calls a courtesy no for today. But I want to have that deeper discussion about the justice reinvestment monies, the nearly $1 million we took out of Department of Corrections for similar treatment and support programs. And so I want to have that further discussion, and I may be a yes a little bit later. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Money's always an issue. Money's this issue, right here and right now. So I know and understand that is always going to be a big concern for folks. But, many years being a social worker and an alcohol and drug counselor, I know that it costs a lot less money for me and my staff to do that work than it does for the Department of Corrections to do that work. And in addition to the Department of Corrections, that would be the Judicial Department and the Police Department and everybody else that would get involved in a situation like that. It is just a long process that brings that costs us a lot of money in this committee. We go through these pieces all the time, right? All of the different pieces that somebody has to touch to get to that final place at the Department of Corrections. And I think any time we can and I hate to even say this, anytime we can pay an alcohol and drug counselor a hell of a lot less money to do that work ahead of time, I think we're doing ourselves a big favor.
Senator Steiner-Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Sanchez said much of what I was going to say, probably more eloquently than I could. But I do want to echo that this is a common sense approach. I also think that there are significant parameter sideboards around the changes in Measure 57. It doesn't apply under these changes do not apply under a wide range of circumstances, previous convictions, other aggravating factors. This is really intended, as best as I understand this, to target the new offender who's most likely committing these two crimes because of an issue with mental health or with drug and alcohol addiction. And I completely agree with Representative Sanchez that treatment in the community or in their local community is a much better place to do this, and it gives us more opportunities to provide that treatment in a place that they're more likely to continue after they're released from DOC supervision. And I commend the people who have worked so hard on this bill. As I mentioned earlier when we heard this bill, I also had a bill that expanded short-term transitional leave because I believe in the success of that program. I'm delighted to see that that's incorporated into this bill and look forward to watching that move forward. I'm pleased with the additional money for justice reinvestment because our communities need that. And I firmly believe that in the long term, maybe even the short term, we will see substantial financial savings without an increase in crime, and probably actually a decrease in crime because people will get the treatment that they need that will prevent them from committing these crimes. We'll see fewer families disrupted, both through the Measure 57 changes and through the FSAP changes, fewer interactions with child welfare. These are the kinds of earlier interventions that are very important for us to be focusing on upstream. So I'm very grateful to everybody who worked so hard on this bill, and I think there are a variety of highly positive ramifications.
Thank you. Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Senator Winters. So I just would like to say that, and again, I'm sort of duplicating what has been said, but I'll try to be very quick. We all know that prevention is far less expensive than incarceration. We've known that for a long, long time. But it seems that this program has really brought this through the justice reinvestment, brought that to fruition, that we have really seen some results from that. And when we talk about Measure 57, I can't remember how long ago Measure 57 came into being, but I know I was a much younger police officer at that time. So it's far different times now. We're in a different place where we have these opportunities, again, to give, whether it's a second or first or a second chance or an opportunity to be engaged more with families and the bringing in a whole package of success for the people that we serve. I believe we save money now when we are using the justice reinvestment, the sentencing alternative. Those options weren't there for us 10, 15 years ago. I think we have an opportunity to see lives and families reconnected and supported within a community, and I just again applaud the efforts also of this committee. Chair Winters, I have learned a heck of a lot from you this session, and I really appreciate that as well. So we're going to continue the good fight and do what's right for the folks of the state of Oregon.
Thank you. And just to add to some of the comments that have already been made, the additional dollars, we funded the Justice the justice reinvestment at current service level. We made no reductions coming in. This $7 million is an addition to, just so you know for the record. Also for the record, and I've had extensive conversation with Mike Schmidt about the utilization of the $7 million. They will be targeted to continue the work that we have started that we know that's working. and working with those counties, and I've shared this both in my conversation with the district attorney, sheriffs, and other stakeholders and county commissioners. I think it's very important that we actually do the work and make certain that the dollars that we are giving to through justice reimbursement are getting the results that I think that we all want. And so, you know, I know that CJC is right there with us. I know that, that DOC is there with us. And we have developed these partnerships. Additionally, we looked at the issue of what would happen if we remove 57, and we asked CJC to go back and do some bed forecasting for us. It came back. We won't get the impact that we all are looking for to happen. So it was with those. I also might add, when we first started this conversation and about the bed savings and looking at the at what was occurring with the female population and with that having to open the, I call it the old women's prison out on State Street. And we wanted to avoid that. We know that's a cost going forward of $20 million plus. And we felt that we could do better with those dollars, could be served better doing treatment in our communities rather than continuing. I've further done some asking of DOC, because when I looked at the theft one and ID theft, I asked the question, how many veterans do we currently have in DOC that would fall in this cat, you know, that we there now have in DOC, and it's 2,000 or plus? How many of those would actually be theft one and what have you? I understand there's some way, and I believe that Elizabeth is there. I think I got a number of 8% or 10%. The universe that we're talking about that affects the population is far more than what I think that we thought when we started this study. Mm-hmm. Let alone to add, as the good Senator Steiner Haywood mentioned, the impact of families and kids that are also attached to this. So I, too, want to commend the work group that worked with us on bringing this forward. And hopefully we will see, as we go forward in the future, you know, some real positives. I think we all can agree that you know, years ago, we didn't think about the front end of doing treatment for the drug and alcohol. Today, we know that that's pervasive and has led to a lot of other crimes. So I want to thank all of you for the comments. So with that, if there's no further comments or questions or what have you, co-chair, start.
Did I make the motion?
You did?
Discussion on the motion.
Yeah, it was the discussion on the motion.
Discussion on the motion.
Oh, yes. Objection. So. Oh, one objection. Two objections. Thank you. So I will take it to the floor. Who would like to take it to the floor in the House? Peluso.
My hand twitching.
I think you're on the bill, right?
Right.
Shall we co-carry on this?
It'll be all right.
It's on the Senate floor. So I will close that hearing on 3078. Are we done for the day? I promised to get everyone out by before 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, mission. But I know you guys have floor. We will have other committees. And I, Ms. Naberka, have you got something for us that you need for tomorrow?
No, Madam Co-Chair, we... Excuse me, currently have 4 bills that will be in front of you tomorrow, and we'll see you then.
Thank you. With that, thank you all. We are adjourned. With that, thank you all. We are adjourned. Thank you.